From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. On today's show, an investigative report by Michigan Radio finds some teachers in one already troubled school district are not certified to teach in Michigan.
Pretty clear within the first 5-10 minutes that I either had really bad record keeping or something that I should look at.
And speaking of teachers, two-thirds of people in Michigan believe we need to hold teachers more accountable. That's according to a new report from the Center for Michigan. We'll talk to education leaders about that report.
Why would teaching be the only profession in America where a consistently bad performer is not let go?
And finally, some schools could lose their mascots because they offend Native Americans. A tough sell for some communities. All of that and more coming up on today's Stateside. But first, the news. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham in for Cynthia Canty. Two-thirds of Michiganders say we need to hold teachers more accountable. That's according to a major report on K-12 public education in our state recently out from the Center for Michigan. It's a nonpartisan, nonprofit think tank. We'll find out what education leaders in Michigan are saying about that report and hear their ideas for ways to improve Michigan schools. And we'll have an update on the medical marijuana debate in Lansing. And if 35 Michigan schools might have to give up their mascots. But first, public records show a number of uncertified teachers are working at the new charter school system in Muskegon Heights. Michigan Radio's Lindsay Smith looked into that.
Teachers in Michigan have to have some kind of certificate or permit to teach. Public school, charter school, doesn't matter. It's the law. If they don't,
it's a big problem.
That's Phil Smith. He's the legislative and policy chair for the Michigan Association of Teacher Educators. Beyond the legal requirements, Smith says there's practical reasons to have certified teachers, mainly to make sure they're prepared.
Would you want to have somebody up in front of your kiddo who doesn't have the experience and knowledge to teach them all the things that we want kiddos to know?
School districts are supposed to verify the teachers they hire are state certified. It's so easy to do, anyone can go online and look up their kids' teacher's certification. But sometimes school districts don't check. Nearly 50 districts are likely to get penalized this year. In Muskegon Heights, public records show at least 8 teachers were not certified. That's about 10% of the teaching staff. But to be fair, the situation at Muskegon Heights schools is not typical. It's Michigan's first privatized public school district. Last summer, its emergency manager laid off everyone because the district was so broke it couldn't afford to open in the fall. Instead, the emergency manager hired Mosaica Education, a for-profit charter school company, to run the schools. They only had around 5 weeks to set up everything. Then they had problems keeping teachers from quitting. Mosaica Education CEO Mike Connolly says the company hired some teachers who weren't certified yet, but that the company believed were eligible for certification. He says it was the teacher's responsibility to get certifications from Michigan's Department of Education, or MDE.
I think for the most part the teachers followed up. Whether they submitted everything that MDE required them to submit it or wanted them to submit it, whether MDE had additional questions, what caused the delay with respect to these particular teachers, I don't know. I don't know if Elena has any more information on that.
Elena Zachary Ross is the company's regional vice president, basically the superintendent of Muskegon Heights schools.
When we contact Michigan Department of Education and they say pending approval, you know, those are the types of things that we had these teachers notified that if you can't prove certification that you would no longer be able to work.
But under the law, people aren't allowed to teach until they actually get approval. And some of these people were hired last August. Connolly admits some responsibility for not following up.
There's a difference between putting someone who is unqualified in front of a classroom and putting someone who is completely qualified, totally eligible for certification, and who is just waiting for the government to issue the certification papers.
Michigan's Department of Education wouldn't do an interview for this story, but MDE says some of these teachers didn't even apply for proper permits until last week, right around the time Michigan Radio started asking questions. In fact, a few have already managed to get certified. MDE is now investigating the matter. The department can issue fines for each day an uncertified teacher was in the classroom. Records obtained through a Freedom of Information Act request show those fines could add up to more than $100,000 in Muskegon Heights. Not only that, but the contract between Mosaica Education and Muskegon Heights Charter Schools says the company has to follow state laws. If it doesn't, it could be grounds to revoke the five-year contract worth at least $8.5 million. The Charter School Board and the district's emergency manager did not respond to requests for an interview for this story.
That's reporter Lindsay Smith, who joins us now from Grand Rapids. First of all, really solid work there, Lindsay. You're to be congratulated. So how'd you find out about this, or how did it become evident that there were uncertified teachers at this new charter school system in Muskegon Heights?
Well, Lester, I had a teacher tip me off, a certified teacher who had concerns that a colleague of theirs was not certified, and I had some Freedom of Information Act requests from the series that I did in January, and I started poking around a little bit, and it was pretty clear within the first 5-10 minutes that I either had really bad record keeping or something that I should look at further. So that's where I got it from.
Now, Mosaica, who's running the schools in Muskegon Heights, supposed to be a shiny example of how privatization of the schools would work, seems not following the law kind of puts a tarnish on that. What kind of a reaction are we hearing from the education community at large?
I'm not super surprised by the reaction. You have people who are part of teachers unions and, in the public education world that are thrilled to see this kind of a thing. They were thrilled to see that one in four teachers quit when I broke that in late November at the same school district. So that's sort of an obvious response. But I've also heard from just today from some people who work at the company or whose family members work at the company, and there's some larger, there's some issues there that they're concerned about that they also think I should be looking into. Some of these things don't surprise me. I mean, setting up the school district in less than 5 weeks was a huge, huge ask. The company itself will say that it was really tough and that it's been tough to find teachers, to retain teachers that are certified, that are highly qualified. Certain areas, especially special education, they've been looking for those kinds of teachers for months. So those are some of the reactions that I've got just today.
I'm wondering if you talked to any parents and what their reaction might have been.
I haven't heard from any parents yet today. I can't say right now. I will say that, in the past, some of the stuff that's come out, it goes both ways. So parents are concerned. Obviously, they want, what's best for their kids. But they also don't like being the focus of negative attention and sort of worry that, in general, bad talk about Muskegon Heights in the school district reflects poorly on their kids. And I understand that too. They're trying to do what's best for their kids. They may not be in the best situation to put their kids, in schools of choice or that kind of a thing. So it's kind of a tough spot for them. Although I will say that a number of parents have sort of tipped me off to some things that I've looked in the past as well. So that they are concerned.
We just, as we just heard in your report, some teachers were hired without teacher certification. They did get certified since, but others have not. What will happen with those teachers who have yet to be certified?
Those teachers, that aren't certified they did tell me that there are some that are not certified that are in the classroom. That is illegal, technically. But at the same time, they have had problems finding teachers, retaining teachers, that sort of a thing. They do have a lot of long-term subs, and in the moment right now, they're working to make sure that they get all of those teachers certified. There is a way to get emergency permits through the state that I think that's going to be an option for them to make sure that the teachers that they have that are good teachers that are, you know, a lot of these teachers are qualified to teach. They just hadn't technically gotten certified yet.
Maybe certified in another state, but not Michigan.
Correct. Yeah. Or you know, had the right education, but sort of never followed through and got the certification.
I understand Mosaica's argument that they had a very short time to put a school district together. It was a tough, tough job. But they signed contracts, as you said, and they knew that some of these teachers weren't certified. But shifting the blame and saying, well, we expected them to get certified in time without verifying that they were certified, where does that leave Mosaica?
I wish I could answer that question in an informative way. The problem is that the school board really holds the authority to do anything. Also, the emergency manager in this case, Don Weatherspoon, and neither the school board, the charter school board, or the emergency manager have responded to this information in any way yet. So it just may be too soon to say.
All right. Lindsay Smith is our reporter in Western Michigan. Thanks very much. What a great report. Appreciate the time.
Thanks, Lester.
In other news around the state, Michigan Attorney General Bill Schuette is appealing the dismissal of conspiracy charges against two former aides to a Detroit area congressman accused in an election scandal. Schuette filed this claim today with the Michigan Court of Appeals following the January 18th dismissal of the charges against Don Yao Chuang and Paul Sewald. The aides to former U.S. Representative Thaddeus McCotter were sentenced that day in Wayne County Circuit Court to probation and community service on other charges. The conspiracy charge is a felony, and it carries up to 5 years in prison. The men and two others were accused last year in the scandal involving bogus petition signatures. McCotter didn't make the ballot and quit Congress after July, after nearly 10 years, rather than finish his term. Coming up, according to a study by the Center for Michigan, the majority of Michiganders think our teachers aren't prepared for the classroom and want our teachers to be held more accountable. We'll have more on that discussion coming up next on Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham, sitting in for Cynthia Canty. Last month, the Center for Michigan, a nonpartisan, nonprofit think tank, released its major report on K-12 public education in our state. It was the largest effort ever to collect and analyze what the public thinks about Michigan schools and teachers. As we've heard here on Stateside, that report was based on hundreds of meetings with people all over the state, and emerging from those discussions was a clear theme. The best way to improve Michigan schools is to improve the skills of the person standing at the front of the classroom. 2/3 of Michiganders say we need to hold teachers more accountable. 4 out of 5 say they want teachers to be better prepared for the classroom. Stateside's Cynthia Canty spoke with a high school principal, an education expert, and a professor of teacher education to make sense of all these statistics.
So we wanted to explore the questions. How do we teach teachers to do their jobs better? And how do we effectively evaluate our teachers? Joining our program is Jennifer Hammond. She's the principal of Grand Blanc High School, and she sits on the Michigan Council for Educator Effectiveness. Jennifer, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you, Cynthia.
Good to have you with us. Also joining us from the Brookings Institution is education expert Russ Whitehurst. Thank you, Russ, for joining our discussion.
I'm pleased to be with you.
And from Michigan State University, we have a professor of teacher education, Corey Drake. Welcome to the program, Corey.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Jennifer Hammond, I'd like to start with you, if I may. The Center for Michigan report certainly finds that teaching teachers to do a better job and then also a better way to evaluate them, those seem to be overwhelming must-dos for people in Michigan. How is that message being received in the classrooms at your school?
2 years ago, the state of Michigan required each educator, principals, and teachers to be rated on a 4-point scale, highly effective to ineffective. And so with that new policy, it certainly has brought more awareness. And I've seen as a principal an enhanced instruction just based on that small change.
Russ Whitehurst, among the many articles that you've written at the Brookings Institution, you pointed to a study by the New Teacher Project, and it looked at thousands of teachers and administrators in 12 districts over 4 states. And it was noted that all failed to, quote, differentiate meaningfully among levels of teacher effectiveness. So it seems of the thousands of teachers, it seems upwards of 90% got top ratings. It makes me wonder, is it even possible for any group to evaluate itself fairly?
Well, I think left to our own resources, none of us would be would subject ourselves to an evaluation system.
Exactly.
But I think we're getting to the point where certainly policymakers and the general public have come to understand that teachers differ just like professionals elsewhere differ in their performance, and it's important to capture that. And when districts are giving everybody an A grade, they're missing the opportunity to do their jobs and to improve the teaching profession.
And what do you think works best in what you have seen as far as successful evaluation of teachers?
Well, I can tell you some things that aren't working well, and that's to leave to every district, big and small, the responsibility for building a successful evaluation system. This is technical work. It's psychometrically complicated, and it's just too difficult to expect every district to do that. When we see the best systems, we see meaningful classroom observation systems, because most teachers are going to be subject primarily to that, to somebody coming into class and observing what they're doing. And so rather than just having some simple checklist, the better efforts are doing this in a sophisticated way, and they're checking on how well the system works, and they're using it and using multiple observations to make judgments about teachers. And they're using it as an opportunity to help teachers grow, to make the evaluation not just a score that a teacher gets, but an opportunity for that teacher to take a look at her practice and try to improve it.
So it's effective. It's not one where virtually everybody gets an A.
Absolutely.
Jennifer, you've begun working with the Michigan Council for Educator Effectiveness. You started at the end of 2011, and among its many goals, the council is tasked with coming up with a state evaluation tool for teachers and then presenting it to the Board of Education, the legislature, and the governor. What would you consider a good, effective system to evaluate a teacher, and are there any districts in Michigan that you would think are doing a good job of that?
Well, I think Russ hits on quite a few of the points that the council has found as well, that any good system is about growing or enhancing instruction. And certainly, and I think the other piece that Russ mentioned is local districts on their own, that is a lot to ask. It is labor intensive, and there is a lot of statistics associated with developing a meaningful system. There are certainly districts in the state of Michigan that are doing things very well, but they're not doing things the same. So if you are in one district and you rate a teacher as highly effective, that would look different in another district. And the purpose of the council was to create a system, or is to create a system, that is somewhat more familiar to everyone, using the same language, the same type of observation protocol, so that whether you're in Grand Blanc or you're in Farmington, there is a similar expectation when you rate a teacher as highly effective or effective.
Now, I want to bring another theme into our conversation and turn to Professor Corey Drake of Michigan State. The Center for Michigan Study found that 4 out of 5 people in Michigan want teachers to be better prepared when they step up to the head of that classroom. What do the schools training teachers need to do better than perhaps they have been, Corey?
Well, I think it's a constantly shifting landscape, and I think a lot of the perception of teachers needing to be better prepared comes from the changes that are happening in the educational system. Teachers are being asked to respond to new standards with the Common Core, new assessments, new curricula, increased diversity, and so it makes sense that the public would be asking for teachers to be better prepared for that. This is a conversation that's ongoing at Michigan State, and I know at other colleges of education, in terms of what can we do in a very limited period of time to make sure that all of our graduates are ready to start on day one, ready to teach, but also ready to continue learning as they teach, continue adapting to the constantly changing landscape. So we've been working hard to identify those key practices that teachers need to have on day one, and then those that they can continue to develop as they continue teaching. And perhaps even, I think, in the most optimistic world, these evaluation systems might help with that ongoing learning process.
If you're just joining us, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty, and we are exploring the questions of evaluating our teachers and basically teaching our teachers to do their jobs better. And we're talking with Jennifer Hammond, who's the principal of Grand Blanc High School, and also she's on the Michigan Council for Educator Effectiveness. We have from Michigan State University, Professor of Teacher Education, Corey Drake, and from the Brookings Institution, education expert, Russ Whitehurst. Russ, the whole conversation that we're having, not just in Michigan, but nationally about improving our schools and focusing on teacher evaluation. When has this become something that went onto the national front burner?
It's certainly been within the last 15 years, and the action has really started within the last 4 or 5 years. Everybody has the intuition that they're good teachers and bad teachers. When I give talks, I ask people to raise their hand if they can remember a great teacher in their life, and almost everybody does. And then I ask them if they can raise their hand if they can remember a terrible teacher in their life, and again, almost every hand goes up. And so that intuition is there, but we've only been able to measure it relatively recently. It really has to do with the advent of testing in grades 3 through 8, which gave the opportunity to see student gains, and on top of that, we have these observational systems. So really, the last 5 years is when some states, a few districts have started getting into this seriously, and the snowball is now heading downhill.
I'm interested, actually, in getting the view of all of you. As we talk about evaluating teachers, it raises the question, what needs to happen when a teacher is evaluated as not effective? Jennifer, I'll start with you since you're a principal.
Well, if a teacher is not effective, the point of an evaluation system or the purpose should be to help support that teacher.
So not punitive.
Maybe not punitive, right. And so maybe a teacher is having difficulty with classroom management techniques. So that's part of the evaluation system. And then you as an evaluator or principal in the classroom can have some very specific conversations with that teacher and support them, whether that's professional development, whether that is mentoring, whatever that would be to help that teacher improve in that area. So it's about supporting teachers, not about punishing or firing teachers.
Why would teaching be the only profession in America where a consistently bad performer is not let go? I certainly agree that, the first step with any evaluation system is to try to improve the performance of the employee who's not doing a good job. But to tenure a teacher who is not doing well, make a lifetime commitment, to make $1.5 million financial commitment to somebody who's not doing well when you have the option to replace that person, doesn't seem to me to be well-grounded in the needs of the students that are supposed to be served by the school system.
I would agree with that. I think, as we're talking about first steps of what happens when a teacher is identified as not effective, we have not had systems in place that really could marshal the resources to support that teacher, and then down the road say we've really given them a fair chance to become an effective teacher. Absolutely. I think after the supports and the resources have been tried, there may be some people, I'm sure there are some people who should not continue in the classroom, but I think it's typically been a sink or swim profession, and so my hope is that we use these evaluations to build a system of support so that we truly identify those who are not effective teachers and distinguish those from teachers who could do a great job with a little bit more support.
And also, as part of the legislation in Michigan, if a teacher performs at the lowest level after, I believe it's 3 years, then they must be terminated. So that is in the new Michigan law.
So that it's coming along. The law is listening to concerns. It does make me wonder, to get the thoughts of all of you on just what you think it takes to make a good teacher, because it strikes me that being an effective and a good teacher, it's more than just what they know. It's more than the knowledge base. There's the heart part of teaching, the heart. And is it even possible to quantify and evaluate that?
I think one of the things we've learned in the last 15 years is that the best predictor of future teacher performance in the classroom is past teacher performance in the classroom, and that we don't yet know a lot about how to make a good teacher or how to take an ineffective teacher and make that teacher a lot better. And it's really a statement on our ignorance about the skills that are needed for the job, but it clearly is a complicated task. It involves not just knowledge, but the ability to control a classroom, to motivate students, to be inspiring. And so we need to eventually look at all of those things. And my hope is that one of the products of the new evaluation system will be a much better sense than we have now about what the components of excellent teaching are, so that we would be in a good position for the first time to train teachers to be effective on their first day in the classroom. We're clearly not good at doing that now.
Yeah, let me ask you, Professor Corey Drake, as you work with teachers through your work at Michigan State University, and what is it, in your view, can you see when they're sitting in your classroom, who's going to make it and who really maybe should think of another line of work?
Well, again, I think this is very parallel. It's a great question, and it's very parallel to what is happening in the K-12 system, where we've had some intuitive or instinctive sense as we watch our prospective teachers grow and we watch them practice teaching in the classroom. You know, some of them you can always look at and say, wow, she's going to be a great teacher, or he's going to be a fabulous teacher. And others you wonder more about. And so I think we have been working hard at getting better at developing assessments in a very similar way that help us document that, think about what evidence we can see when we know a teacher is going to be great versus those who, again, need this extra support. And I think an important shift has been one you alluded to, from measuring what it is that people know, because that's an important part of teaching, but what we're really interested in is what they can do when mm-hmm. they're in a classroom and what kinds of practices they enact and how they interact with all of their students. And so we've moved a great deal from assessments of knowledge and beliefs, which are important, to really focusing before they leave our program on assessments of practice. What is it that they actually are doing when they're in a classroom? And does that give us confidence that from day one they'll be able to support the learning of all of their students?
Jennifer Hammond, you're right there on the front line interacting with teachers and interacting with parents and interacting with students. What do parents not understand about the daily job of the teacher?
Well, I think being a teacher it's artful in its truest sense. And I think you hit on it earlier about the heart of teaching. You can know your content very well, but you also have to love what you do and love working with young people. You make thousands of decisions in an hour. You are managing behavior and academics at all times. And the pressures and accountability are certainly higher stakes now. And so I think that's what those who are not in the classroom on a regular basis may not realize, that it is very difficult work. And those who do it well, they always make it look so easy and so natural. And so I think this whole idea of evaluation stems from those that make it look so easy and are so good at it, there must be a way to capture that so that everyone else can do the same thing. But it is an art form.
Yeah, that's a good point. If Russ Whitehurst, if we're all having this conversation in 5 years based on what you're seeing nationally, certainly what we've heard in this report from the Center for Michigan, what do you think we'll be talking about in terms of evaluating our teachers?
We'll be using more information from students about the evaluation of their teachers. That's currently not on the table at all in K-12, whereas it's routinely used in post-secondary. And we now know for the first time that students are actually pretty good judges of teachers and how they are in the classroom and how inspiring they are and how well they teach. So we'll be using more of that. We'll have standardized instruments that will be off the shelf and easier to use rather than everybody collecting their own. And I think we'll have tied colleges of education into schools in a way that colleges are going to be judged on how well they're preparing teachers for the classroom. That link is presently absent.
And let me just then segue right over to Corey Drake, Michigan State professor. Your thoughts on where we'll be in 5 years and what we'll be talking about, especially in the way you're training teachers.
Well, I agree with Russ in all the directions that we are heading. I think his last point about connecting the preparation of teachers to the ultimate achievement of their K-12 students, I think, is definitely a direction we're heading. And so what I'd like to see happen along with that, and I think these teacher evaluation systems might help us do that, is a more seamless connection between the preparation of new teachers that happens in colleges of education and the ongoing support of practicing teachers that happens mostly in schools and districts. And if we can be coherent about the way we prepare and support teachers all the way along the continuum, evaluating them in uniform ways, asking them to do the same kinds of things, but at higher levels as they progress as teachers, I think we can support teachers much more effectively and therefore have more teachers being rated as effective or highly effective.
And Jennifer Hammond, based on your work as the principal as well as being on the Michigan Council for Educator Effectiveness, what do you predict will be in the five-year period?
Well, I think around our profession as educators, there's going to be certainly a clear understanding of really what's expected and what is high quality. And we haven't had that before. And so I think with that conversation and those expectations, I anticipate a much more enhanced and engaging K-12 instructional force.
You've all brought many great insights, and I know this is the first of many conversations that we will be having, and hopefully to have you back on Stateside as we continue exploring this. Michigan State University Professor of Teacher Education, Corey Drake, from the Brookings Institution Education Expert, Russ Whitehurst, and from Grand Blanc High School Principal, Jennifer Hammond. Thank you so much for joining us on Stateside.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Tomorrow, Cynthia Canty talks with one of the top finalists for National Teacher of the Year on what works in the classroom. And coming up on this show, the medical marijuana debate continues in Lansing and trouble with school mascots. That's next on Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham, sitting in for Cynthia Canty, who's away. Well, things are heating up in the marijuana debate in the state. Maybe I should say things are smoking in Lansing. Lawmakers are proposing bills for and against how marijuana is used and supplied, but there are some other things going on. The Attorney General wants to restrict medical marijuana as much as he possibly can since the people voted to legalize it. And on Friday, the Michigan Supreme Court ruled the medical marijuana dispensaries can be shut down as a public nuisance. That same day, a Michigan lawmaker was quickly introducing a bill to legalize medical marijuana shops. Keeping an eye on all of that is the Capitol Bureau Chief for Michigan Public Radio Network and my friend, Rick Pluta. So, Rick, what's happening with the dispensaries? What's going to happen?
Obviously, we don't know for sure that the voter-approved law is complicated. Patching the holes in that law is complicated. But, you know, really, you're talking about a few different issues here. You mentioned that Attorney General Bill Schuette, who, by the way, led the campaign against approving this when it was on the ballot, wants the law interpreted as tightly and as restrictively as possible, which means things like no marijuana dispensaries. But, you know, then there are people like State Representative Mike Calton, a Republican, by the way, who says that, well, voters approved this for a reason, and that whatever the legislature does to implement that law ought to respect that.
There's not enough caregivers for the 126,000 patients in Michigan, and it doesn't take into account the needs of the cancer patient. Say, if you got a death sentence of 3 to 6 months to live, by the time you got plants going or someone got plants going for you, it takes 4 to 6 months to get plants online, and that patient may well be dead.
And so we've got a situation where, you know, one, that you know, voters really did approve this for relief, whether you agree with that as a legitimate medical diagnosis or not, but voters approve this as a mechanism for relief for people who are terminally ill. And Mike Calton says, you know, this is something that the system ought to respect. Another thing too, Lester, is that, you know, growing marijuana, as you know, is not an exact science. That people
not that much of a green thumb, but thanks. Go ahead.
That you know, the people who are responsible for growing, I mean, it's a plant that sometimes you grow more than what you need, and when that happens, well, what happens to that overage? The law says you're supposed to destroy it, but we don't know if people are destroying it. We don't know if people are taking it out and selling it on the black market. And dispensaries helps solve that dilemma.
So dispensaries, basically, without them, we're causing a supply and demand problem.
that there's this supply and demand problem, and there's also tracking people's extra medical marijuana.
All right. So it's regulation, it's supply and demand, it's making sure that people who need medical marijuana have it when they need it.
Now, exactly.
While all this is going on, this debate is going on, we've got State Representative Jeff Irwin, a Democrat from Ann Arbor, and he says, the heck with it. Let's just go after decriminalizing marijuana in Michigan, not just for medical uses. States like Colorado and Washington have done this. How likely will we see that bill make any progress in the state legislature?
I wouldn't think that its prospects are great over the next 2 years, but we do see opinion in Michigan evolving on marijuana, that we just had a few more Michigan communities in the last election change their marijuana laws to either decriminalize it or in some cases make it by local ordinance the lowest priority of law enforcement. And so we're starting to see in more and more places, you know, people sort of having this idea that we don't want to spend a lot of time on this. And of course, all of this is happening hand in glove with the national debate over the effectiveness of the war on drugs and things like that. So will it move soon? Probably not. But, you know, even the Republican chair of the House Appropriations Committee, a doctor, State Senator Roger Kahn, has said this is a discussion worth having.
We recently saw a report to the state legislature. It's required by the Michigan Medical Marijuana Act. And this annual report shows that over $10 million in revenue was collected from the administration of the state's medical marijuana program last year. That's more than double the cost of running the program. Has that caught the attention of any lawmakers?
It's caught the attention of a lot of people, but when you talk about medical marijuana and revenue, you're getting into an area that gets people kind of uncomfortable because, you know, there are people who are advocates for the outright decriminalization of or legalization of marijuana who say, look, if people want to do this, why not allow them and tax it just like you would tobacco or alcohol? And so this whole issue of making revenue off marijuana, whether it's medical or otherwise, is one that politically is kind of a hot potato.
We're talking with Rick Pluta. He's the Capitol Chief at Michigan Public Radio Network. So I want to talk about one other thing. The Michigan Department of Civil Rights has asked for a federal ban on names and mascots at schools that include Native American imagery. Now, in my home county, there are the Clinton Redskins and the Tecumseh Indians. Every once in a while, I'll see protests against the use of the names and the images, especially the Redskins, which is particularly offensive to Native Americans. What's the likelihood that the feds will take action on that request, and what's the debate?
Well, I can't speak to what the likelihood of federal action is on it. Obviously, this is, in politics, we talk about some issues that are third rails, and local high school mascots are definitely one of them. I mean, it speaks to things like one of the reasons why it's so problematic getting school districts to combine, even if it saves taxpayers a lot of money, is which mascot are you going to adopt? People take this personally, and what the Michigan Department of Civil Rights has done is no exception. As a matter of fact, just today, Lester, there was a meeting of a House Appropriations Budget Subcommittee, and where the Department of Civil Rights testified, and State Representative Anthony Forlini had this to say to the department.
I think that we're looking at crazy things, and I'm not sure where this is all going, but I got to believe this is way overstepping the bounds of where you should be in your department. And this kind of stuff, I think to file against our own school districts, you're with our state, with the federal government, to me just seems nuts.
And we're talking about 35 school districts in Michigan, and not all of them are necessarily names that people find overtly offensive. Sometimes they're names like the Warriors. But what the State Department of Civil Rights says is that it's not just a matter of whether or not people are offended. And this is what Leslie Fritz of the Civil Rights Department had to say in response to Representative Forlini's complaint.
Up until now, the discussion that has gone on in local communities has been a question of what is offensive. Did the school districts intend to offend? Are reasonable people offended by what they're seeing, what they're hearing in chants and such? what our complaint filing argues is that that is really no longer the issue that's at play here. That, in fact, the research shows that the use of American Indian mascots, imagery, et cetera, is harming children's performance in the classroom.
So what she says is there's actual science backing up this idea that regardless of whether people find a particular name offensive or not, that this is affecting student performance, American Indian student performance in the classroom.
Now, this request by the Michigan Department of Civil Rights to the federal government to put a ban on mascots in schools. Let me ask you, if the Washington Redskins came to play the Lions at the Ford Field, would that have an effect, or are we just talking about high schools?
No. We are just talking about schools. It doesn't mention professional teams. It does not mention colleges or universities, and we have a few of those in Michigan. The sanction would be the loss of federal K-12 education funds, so you couldn't reach any of them anyway. And the NCAA, at least, although obviously the NFL is not, the NCAA has come up with a solution, which is that a college or university is expected to negotiate with the relevant tribal authority as to whether or not a name is offensive or under what circumstances it might be used, which is why, for example, Central Michigan University is still allowed to use the name the Chippewas.
Now, the representative for Alini seemed to suggest that the Department of Civil Rights is becoming a rogue agency going to the federal government. Why didn't the agency go to its commission and make a recommendation to the legislature that something like this happened at the state level rather than going to the federal government?
Well, that's a great question. But, you know, one of the things it speaks to is that the Civil Rights Commission is governed by, as you noted, a commission that a majority of its members were named not by Governor Rick Snyder, a Republican, but by Governor Jennifer Granholm, his predecessor, who was a Democrat, and the department director is basically someone who was suggested by her. And so this is sort of outside the realm of the controlling Republican interests in Lansing.
Ah. All right, Rick, anything else happening in Lansing we should be keeping our eye on?
lots and lots all the time that, you know, we're still waiting to see what's going to happen with the financial situation in Detroit and whether the governor is actually going to pull the trigger on a state takeover and naming an emergency financial manager. I don't think we'll see anything on that this week, though, but be looking for it early next week.
All right, Rick, thanks very much. Rick Pluta is the Capitol Bureau Chief for the Michigan Public Radio Network, and you'll hear him frequently here on Michigan Radio. Thanks very much.
Oh, my pleasure, Lester.
Now, if you're still a little dazed and confused over Michigan's medical marijuana law, to sort out all the twists and turns, you can check out an interactive timeline on our website. My colleague Mark Brush traces the major events from the law's passage in 2008. To last week's Supreme Court ruling, just go to michiganradio.org. It'll be right at the top of the page. If you sit down to watch a local TV newscast or a cable news broadcast or to read a newspaper or, well, I don't know, listen to NPR here on Michigan Radio, how do you feel afterward? What do you think of the world? What do you think of your hometown? Now, if you come away dissatisfied, angry, feeling disconnected, you're not alone. Eastern Michigan University journalism professor Christine Tracy was so troubled by what she saw in news reporting and the consumption of news, she wrote a book about it, The News Fear, Understanding the News and Information Environment. Stateside Cynthia Canty spoke to Christine Tracy earlier this year.
Christine, it's very clear from your book that you're very troubled with the way that news is produced, as well as the way it's consumed. You point to the debate style of most reporting today as a problem with how news is produced. What do you mean by that?
I studied the media system on many different levels, and I looked at the work of many different theorists. There's a whole national conference for media reform. And I decided we really had to work on a solution, mm-hmm. right? It wasn't useful anymore to sort of criticize and, you know, the media in sort of quotation marks. But what's happened is an increasing polarization, right? The debate style news is there's one side there's the other side, and that's it. There now, are no multiple sides.
So what you're hoping that we could move to as a society is what you call a dialogue style. Give us an example of what that might be like.
A dialogue style is when you listen better. It's really more about listening, and listening with the belief that what someone says might actually change your mind and encourage you to think differently about something.
Christine, in the book, you certainly spend time challenging the reporters and the editors who produce the news. So what do you see is wrong about the way that news is being covered? And
one of the primary things I see is that there isn't enough original reporting, that people repeat stories that other people start, and the boots on the ground really doing the digging. More of that kind of reporting needs to be done. The second thing I would say is to try to provide more context for stories and to realize that some stories are very complex and that people need time to fully integrate and understand the context and the meaning behind the story, to really educate audiences about complex issues like physical and economic issues or international policy that can't be received in just one story, to not try to shortcut the educational and informational responsibility of journalism.
Now, you do point out, back to audiences, that news consumers are often guilty of doing something they accuse the media of, and that is manipulation. Explain this backfire effect to us.
It's a really interesting phenomenon that researchers, political scientists here at the University of Michigan discovered, that even when people are presented with factual information, so they have the facts, the journalists have got it right, if they don't have an existing frame of understanding to take in this information, instead of using it right to and taking it in the right way, they distort it. So it only confirms their existing beliefs.
So what price, Christine, do you feel that we're paying, start with as a society, for all of this sourness, if you will, and all of this polarization that's coming out of that, and from people saying, that's it, I'm not watching any more news, or I'm not reading any more news, I'm fried out. Mm-hmm. What price do we pay?
I think there's a level of anxiety that people don't even realize that that exists. When they hear bad news, sometimes they feel like they have to respond. And as human beings, when we take in really negative or tragic stories, we have to do something with that. So that's one price. The other price, I believe, is disengagement. To really function, we sort of throw up our hands and say, you know what, I don't understand this. I can't take it in anymore.
I can't make a difference.
Right. What I say doesn't matter. All these other people are louder than me. Their voices are louder. Their voices are more powerful. I don't really have any power. And that's the key premise of my book, that we, each one of us, has a responsibility to ourselves to own the power that we do have. And that to begin by being more conscious and perhaps going on a news diet.
So what would that look like? If I followed your advice and I began a news diet tomorrow morning, what would that look like?
That would look like, you don't look at your smartphone, that might be really hard. Turn off the radio. Don't listen to the radio in your car. Don't turn on the television if you have the television on. Look at different programming. And really sort of almost detox, right? Get it out of your system, and then slowly introduce new sources.
Like you would food to a baby.
Like you would food to a baby, exactly. And when you introduce those sources, look at introducing new sources that perhaps come from a different political stance than you might normally take. So then you can start to see how maybe different sources would cover the same story.
The book is The News Sphere, Understanding the News and Information Environment, written by Christine Tracy. She's a professor of journalism and rhetoric at Eastern Michigan University. It's been a real pleasure talking with you today.
Thank you. Thank you, Cindy.
Today's Stateside was produced and directed by Mercedes Mejia. Our executive producer is Zoe Clark. The program was engineered by Peg Watson. Contributors are Allie Billings, Emily Fox, Maya Friedman, and Austin Davis. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Lester Graham. Thanks for listening. Talk to you tomorrow afternoon at 3:00.